labor union. While Amazon is fighting the unionization drive, the company's CEO, Jeff Bezos, has made $65 billion over the past year during the pandemic. That's an average of over $7 million an hour. And a mass shooting at a supermarket in Boulder, Colorado, has taken 10 lives. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Boulder, Colorado, a gunman opened fire without warning at a supermarket Monday afternoon, killing 10 people. Witnesses described a horrific scene of bodies littering supermarket aisles as the shooter systematically fired round after round at shoppers without saying a word. Police injured a white male suspect outside the King Soopers grocery store and took him into custody. He has not been identified, and no motive in the killings is known. Among those shot dead was 51-year-old police officer Eric Talley, who was the first on the scene. Resident Stephen McHugh dropped his family members off at the supermarket's pharmacy, where his son-in-law was in line for a COVID-19 vaccine with his two grandchildren. McHugh said the family witnessed people being shot around them and hid in a closet until the police rescued them.
It's not okay that we don't have better gun control laws. Let me just say that. It's not, you know, when it's your family, this has got to stop. Every week in the United States, there's a shooting. Now it's our turn, and that should never be repeated anywhere.
The killer used an AR-15 semi-automatic assault rifle. Just last week, a Colorado state judge blocked Boulder ordinances barring assault weapons and large-capacity magazines, ruling in favor of the National Rifle Association's Colorado affiliate and two Boulder residents. The NRA is in a deeply weakened state. It filed for bankruptcy last year after New York State Attorney General Letitia James sued them for fraud, seeking to dissolve the organization. The Senate Judiciary Committee is holding hearings this afternoon on gun control. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is warning of another rise in COVID-19 cases, with the 7-day average of daily infections up 5% or more in 27 states. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky Monday asked U.S. residents to continue to wear masks, to avoid crowds, and to delay travel, even if they've been vaccinated.
We are at a critical point in this pandemic, a fork in the road where we as a country must decide which path we are going to take. We must act now, and I am worried that if we don't take the right actions now, we will have another avoidable surge, just as we are seeing in Europe right now, and just as we are so aggressively scaling up vaccination.
The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases said Tuesday that drug maker AstraZeneca may have submitted outdated information about its COVID-19 vaccine that provided an incomplete view of efficacy data from a late-stage clinical trial in the U.S. The development could complicate AstraZeneca's application to the Food and Drug Administration for emergency use authorization. Here in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo says all state residents age 50 and older are now eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine. Meanwhile, West Virginia has become the third U.S. state to offer vaccines to all adults, joining Alaska and Mississippi. More than 82 million U.S. residents have received at least one dose of the vaccine, about 1 in 4 people nationwide. The head of the World Health Organization is calling on vaccine makers to license their technologies to other manufacturers, calling growing vaccine inequity a moral outrage. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus called it shocking that some countries are racing to vaccinate their entire populations, including healthy younger people at lower risk of COVID-19, while healthcare workers and older people and others at high risk go unvaccinated in poorer nations.
The gap between the number of vaccines administered in rich countries and the number of vaccines administered through COVAX is growing every single day and becoming more grotesque every day.
Saudi Arabia has proposed a ceasefire to end its six-year war on Yemen, but Houthi rebels have rejected the deal, saying the Saudis must first fully lift its devastating blockade, which has led to the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Shortly before proposing the ceasefire, Saudi forces carried out air raids, striking dozens of targets in Yemen, including a grains port. In news from Bangladesh, a massive fire in a Rohingya refugee camp has killed at least 15 people and displaced 50,000. Al Jazeera reports 400 people remain missing. The fire began in a camp in Cox's Bazar, then spread to two others, destroying thousands of shelters. Nearly a million Rohingya refugees live in southern Bangladesh after fleeing a military crackdown in Burma in 2017. It was the third fire at the camps in recent days. One survivor told Reuters, quote, "When we were in Burma, they destroyed everything. Now it's happened again." At least 137 people have been killed in Niger after gunmen on motorbikes attacked villages near the border of Mali. It was the deadliest attack in the West African nation in years. The coordinated raids occurred Sunday, on the same day Niger's constitutional court confirmed newly elected President Mohamed Bazoum's victory. Back in the United States, the Senate has confirmed Boston Mayor and former union leader Marty Walsh to be Secretary of Labor. Walsh becomes the first labor secretary to come from a union background in nearly 50 years. With Walsh's confirmation, Boston City Council President Kim Janey has become interim mayor of Boston, making her the first woman and first person of color to hold the office. The White House is preparing a $3 trillion infrastructure and jobs package as part of President Biden's Build Back Better agenda. Washington Post reports the legislation will be broken into two parts. One package will focus on education and programs to increase the participation of women in the workforce, including paid leave, universal pre-K, and free community college. It would also extend the child tax credit for several years. A second part of the legislation will focus on infrastructure like bridges, roads, and waterways. It would reportedly provide $400 billion to combat climate change, including $60 billion for green transit. In comparison, Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Elizabeth Warren recently proposed a bill that would invest $500 billion in electric public transportation infrastructure. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona has canceled $1 billion in student loans for more than 70,000 people defrauded by for-profit colleges. The decision reverses a move by former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos to limit student loan relief for people impacted by the collapse of for-profit colleges like Corinthian and ITT Technical Institute. Louis DeJoy, the Trump-appointed Postmaster General, is unveiling a sweeping austerity plan for the U.S. Postal Service to reduce postal office hours, increase postage prices, and slow down mail delivery. This comes just days after 50 House Democrats wrote to President Biden urging him to fire the entire Board of Governors of the United States Postal Service, which has the sole power to remove DeJoy from his job. Federal investigators are weighing whether to charge people who joined the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol with seditious conspiracy, the crime of seeking to overthrow the government. The Justice Department has not successfully prosecuted a sedition case in over two decades. This comes as prosecutors are preparing to discuss plea deals with some 300 suspects charged over the January 6th assault, which left five people dead. Over the weekend, Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson made headlines when he falsely claimed the January 6 rioters were not violent.
One of the reasons I'm being attacked is because I've very honestly said I didn't feel threatened on January 6. I didn't. There was much more violence on the House side. There was no violence on the Senate side.
Former President Trump's lawyer, Sidney Powell, sought to dismiss a $1.3 billion defamation lawsuit filed against her by Dominion Voting Systems, saying no one should have believed her repeated false claims of voter fraud in the 2020 election. In a court filing, Powell's lawyers write, quote, "No reasonable person would conclude that the statements were truly statements of fact," unquote. The Supreme Court's agreed to consider the Justice Department's request to reinstate a death sentence for Jokhar Tsarnaev, who's serving life in prison for his role in the deadly 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. Last year, a lower court tossed out his death sentence, but the Trump Justice Department appealed. And in Atlanta, the husband of a woman who died in last week's mass shootings has revealed he was handcuffed and held by police for 4 hours after surviving the attack. Mario Gonzalez said, quote, "I don't know whether it's because of the law or because I'm Mexican. The simple truth is that they treated me badly." He didn't learn his wife, Delaina Ashley Yon, had died for hours. Gonzalez and his wife had gone to the spa together for massages and were in separate rooms when the gunman opened fire. They had married over the summer and had a baby girl. A total of 8 people died in the attacks on 3 Asian-owned spas last Tuesday. 7 of the victims were women, including 6 women of Asian descent. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York City, joined by my...
Welcome back to CKUT. It's time for a little weather. Wednesday will be mainly cloudy with a high of 12 degrees Celsius. Thursday will share a mix of sun and clouds and a high of 19 degrees Celsius. Friday will rain with a high of 10 degrees Celsius. Saturday will be cooler with mixed precipitation. Remember, there can still be snow at 5 degrees. Sunday will continue with a light rain and a high of 7 degrees Celsius. Monday, there will be mixed precipitation and a high of 4 degrees Celsius. Finally, Tuesday will have a mix of sun and clouds and a high of 5 degrees Celsius. Let's continue to hear the second hour's interviews. We'll begin with girl number 3.
Faith and love will carry on. Let's unite, let's be strong. We've got the right to live as
3's self-titled album gives the listener a sense of calming nostalgia for a place or time they have never visited. The mostly instrumental tracks feature warm synth chords, clean, billowy bass, percussive ripples, and melodic lines that sound like they could live in a Studio Ghibli film. With us today, we have the girl from Girl Number 3. Hi, girl, and welcome to the show.
Hi there. How are you doing?
First, please introduce yourself and tell us how you joined Girl Number 3.
So my name is Girl Number 3, and I'm a music producer and visual artist based out of Toronto. Probably best described as experimental, psychedelic, new jazz. And I also create psychedelic entities and landscapes and album artwork and music visualizers for other artists as well.
What is your background as a musician and how do you describe yourself musically?
Well, growing up, I had training in various different instruments, although I never really pursued music in any serious manner until recently. I was always just playing for fun at home. I broke my finger in late 2019, and all I was capable of doing was digitally creating music, really, and especially through COVID. I've really been creating the type of music that I want to hear, weird polyrhythmic fusion music that isn't really quite something that's been done before. And in an attempt to move music forward, as I'm pretty bored with how music's been repeating itself for decades. And my self-titled album is the first of four, which I've completed and plan on releasing over the course of the year.
Who are your bandmates and what does everyone play?
So I am the sole songwriter, composer. I do everything. And I'm a bassist primarily, although I have training in keys, other things. And I am hoping to find a band to do to get live tracks for a future live mix album.
How were you inspired to play psychedelic rock in a world full of modern genres?
So I am heavily, heavily influenced by Frank Zappa. His approach to songwriting I'm most trying to emulate, while also giving nods to Weather Report, Koji Kondo, and Homeshake. Psychedelics also play a huge role in the creation of my music, as well as in the listening, I hope. They help guide my ear to create some very contorted, intriguing pieces that I otherwise wouldn't have landed on by myself. I mean, the general rules are still there that I use to compose, but the actual patterns and melodies are beyond what I would normally recognize for myself.
May we hear some of your music?
Yeah, for sure. My song, The Great Apes, Grapes, Japes, is the second track off my album, and I hope you enjoy it.
Oh, this is Great Apes, Great Japes on the Wednesday morning after. Thank you. said that you chose the name Girl Number Three from your experience growing up as an outcast. How did you choose the name for your band?
So yeah, as you mentioned, growing up, I had a little bit of trouble fitting in and often felt like the background character of the background characters in a film. Just the nameless third girl off to the side, Girl Number Three.
Your latest EP is your self-titled album, Girl Number Three. What is the process you went through writing this album?
So the concept actually started with the fourth track off the album, Artisanal Art is Null, and the prior track before that, Forsake Pete's Sake for Pete for Pete's Sake. Artisanal is a reflection on how artificial intelligence is surpassing our artisanal efforts, even in the artistic realm with AI creating like almost better, if not comparable, art and music. Pete's Sake is a reflection on how man-made climate change and overpopulation is leading to troubles, which we can only solve by forsaking our own sake. And from there, I just kind of got the idea of an album of telling the story of humanity from start to finish, from hiding in caves, taking shelter from the rain, to our supposed metaphysical hereafter.
May we hear some more of your music?
For sure. The next track is track four off of my album, Artisanal Art is Null.
So this is Artisanal Art is Null on CKUT. If our listeners want some free listening time, where should they go?
So you guys can find me on Spotify, YouTube, Instagram. Just search for Girl Number Three, and that's spelled Girl N-O period and three I's, just like Roman numerals. Thanks for having me on, and thanks to everyone for listening.
Well, thank you for your interview today.
For sure. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to The Girl from Girl Number 3, speaking about Girl Number 3. I am your host, Sheila Ferrando.
CKUT's annual funding drive runs Thursday, March 18th to Sunday, March 28th. Our programmers have been working hard at home all year, and it's time to celebrate their efforts. The theme of our first ever online drive is sowing the seeds of grassroots change, and we're asking you to support independent community media. Help us reach our goal of $25,000. Go to cket.ca to donate today.
Sowing the seeds of change, seeds of change. Sowing the seeds, sowing the seeds of change. Seeds of change, sowing the seeds of change.
Helen Oyeyemi wanders the mind through an interesting trail of signs and mongooses, watching people on a pleasant train trip try to resolve everything they find. And lots happens, one thing, then another. But the work here is called Pieces. And while we're getting to know her, let's find out what it's all about. With us today, we have Helen Oyeyemi. Hi, Helen, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Sheila. Thanks for having me.
First, please introduce yourself and tell us how you came to be an accomplished author.
I'm a fiction writer, but more of a fiction reader, actually, who writes as a response mostly to what I read. What else does one need to know about me? I live in Prague. I love Prague. I live here because I love it. My stories are very, very made up. When people ask me what I write, I usually say fiction, and like that's the most that I can say about it because it is very fictional fiction.
You're publishing currently with Penguin Random House Books. Your new novel, a fiction called Pieces, spelled P-E-A-C-E-S. Why did you name this book Pieces?
The epigram is an Emily Dickinson poem about continually feeling that one has found peace and then just coming up against another war. And it kind of feels a little bit like life, especially romantic life, can be like that. You think that you found the one, and then there are various episodes, and then the one is not the one, and then there's the search for the new one, and so on. And because I was writing a book about a couple that was on honeymoon and sort of celebrating having found each other, I just wanted to add that note of wariness.
Why are there mongooses in this story? First one, then two, then they actually leave.
It was a surprise to me too. I was not expecting the mongoose invasion, but I was very ultimately I was very happy that they were there.
What is the significance of naming the main characters by the name Shin?
It's a little bit discussed in the first chapter because they could have taken, so Otto's name before meeting Xavier was Otto Montague, and they have a bit of a discussion about whether they should be Montagues or Shins, but maybe it was just Otto's secret wish to take Xavier's surname that means that they end up being Shins.
How do you relate personally to your story Pieces?
I think I was when I started out, I was very cranky about not having met anyone, and I sort of wanted to write a couple and then punish them for having found each other. But then I turned into a sort of benevolent spectator of their of their deeds and shenanigans.
Will you read us a few pages of Pieces?
Dear Ava, I hope you and Eleglinger, I considered not writing this letter to you, and then I considered not sending it. I have a feeling this is a common reaction among those you've asked to try to put prem in writing. In my case, there's an additional sense of impropriety. It's not right, Will, to gossip and speculate about his state of mind when he wrote it. Anyway, if you're reading this, I found a way to dismiss those scruples. Carol was one of the first students to take my history of music for strings course, you know, and Allegra was one of the last. My first impressions of both students were so wide off the mark, I can only laugh them off. I thought Carol needed a bit more self-confidence and Allegra needed a bit less. They both took an interest in my lecture on an 18th century priest and an instrument he devised, a hypothetical instrument that could not be brought into actuality despite many years of labor. I didn't realize the extent to which that story took hold of Carol Stoyer-Spell's imagination until I read The Ocular Harpsichord. Have you read it, Ava? The novella Carol wrote. It's all in there, in the chilling immediacy of Carol's eye, as he tells of Louis Bertrand Castel's proposal to make music visible to the naked eye, and then every grain of the quicksand that drew him into its embrace as he failed. The ruin of his health and finances, the blighting of his view of creation. Allegra didn't get it. She kept looking all around her during that lecture, seeking the point she was missing in the expressions of the other students. But then A's viable ideas come in clusters. If one doesn't ripen after all, there's still a good chance one of the others will. So why get into a tizzy over the one concept? Carel adores breezy, prodigal talents. He married one after graduation. A former classmate of his, in fact, Poppy Dixon. I was at their wedding, and then they moved to Newcastle once Poppy started as a second violin for the Royal Northern Symphonia. Poppy was a bit too nice for Carol. No, what I mean is that Carol was too cruel for Poppy, but never allowed her to realize it. Carol's cruel streak, his tendency to taunt and prod, so perplexed Poppy that he feared she wouldn't put up with it. He hid that cruel streak from his wife and only showed it to his friends, which was perfectly lovely for us, of course. However, I will let those stories die. We frequently double-dated when they were in town, me and Stefan, Carol and Poppy. We were just about old enough to be their parents, but we probably looked more like their grandparents. Those two had such a glow about them and didn't yet understand about mortgages and things like that. Carol said Poppy gave him music. She'd wake up humming and he'd be off at once, setting what he'd heard into a composition. They had 3 years like that, then a very bad year. Poppy was so gravely ill, and we lost her. My first point about Prem is that I don't know anything about his mother. Carol would allow people to assume Prem is Poppy's son, but he almost certainly isn't. Of course, a downside of long-distance friendship is that it takes some time to become aware of the new factor in your friend's life. I do, however, find it extraordinary that after a decade of quarterly lunches without any mention of a new partner, fling or any development falling between those two posts, Carol introduced me to Prem, who looked to be all of 10 years old. I asked the little boy how old he was, and he smiled at me and said, "Guess." Carol had been ill for about a month prior. He characterized it as a stomach complaint and told me his doctor found nothing wrong, and I believed him at the time, but I don't anymore. I mean, I believe Carol was laid low by what he called a stomach complaint, but I doubt he saw a doctor about it. He probably stayed at home all month, possibly feeling death draw near and shrinking away. And somewhere near the middle of all that, Prem arrived. Dropped off by his mother, probably. I am volunteering this as a guess, even though I don't believe it. I'm not sure what I do believe concerning Premisil. I paid Carol an impromptu visit one evening. I didn't tell him I was coming. I just took the train up to Newcastle and took a taxi to his house. That morning, I had felt that something was the matter and that it might not be too late to fix it as long as I saw Carol that very day. Carol answered the door himself, looking better than I'd seen him in a while, and I felt as if I'd caught myself wishing bad things on him. I got a warm welcome and a cream tea from him, even though darkness was falling. We talked for hours. Prem was about 17 by then. Carol was particularly pleased with how well he was doing at school, and was matter-of-fact about him continuing higher education close to home so that he wouldn't be out at night. I asked him if he didn't think he was being too strict with Prem, and he began a circumspect answer. Then his telephone rang upstairs. He excused himself. There was a call he'd been expecting all day. And almost as soon as he'd gone, Prem was there. I don't mean he had come in. I mean he was there. There was a lamp beside the chair I was sitting in. He switched it on and said, "Yes, Ms. Rashid, he is too strict. Thank you for being on my side."
That was a beautiful piece of work. Thank you. What inspired you to write this novel, Pieces?
I wanted to write a train book, and I'm not sure where I got the idea. I think it might have been from reading Olga Tokarczuk's book, Flight, which is not at all about trains, but it is about crossing boundaries and borders and what happens to our minds and what happens to the borders when we cross them. And she does mention train travel, even though she's mainly talking about flights. And she talks about how, I mean, in the book, the narrator writes about train travel as being very personal, very intimate, the way that you actually have to move with the train, you're crossing land along with the wheels, like it's just much more physical than, say, flying across a border. And then I was like, I'm going to write a train book. And also I love traveling on trains. And so it was possibly an excuse to take more train trips as research. But then trying to decide what kind of train book to write, I mean, the thought of a mystery always comes to you because there are so many like great mysteries and like tense thrillers that sit on trains. So I ended up going a little bit down that path as well.
How did you come to write for Penguin Random House Books?
Penguin Random House was the very first Canadian publisher. This particular imprint, Hamish Hamilton, have published me since my first book. So, and you know, my relationship with my editor has been since I was a surly 19-year-old to now, like half a lifetime later when I'm 36. So it's just a very stable, accepting relationship that I have with my publisher, where my writing has changed so much over all of this time, but I've been sort of consistently backed and approved by my editor. And that's something that I'm very lucky to have in my life.
Where do you see yourself as an author next year?
Oh, next year. Next year, I will have written some of my Prague book. I'm planning to start a Prague book this summer, and I'm very scared because it's such a big thing to try. This is such a... it's a city that sort of slips through your fingers. So I guess I'm going to try and write it with open hands. So next year I will have become a little bit of a Prague author, one hopes.
Well, thank you for your interview today.
Thank you so much, Sheila.
You are listening to Helen Oyeyemi speaking about her novel Pieces. I am your host, Sheila Ferrando.
This is Solidarity News on Radio Labour.
This is a Radio Labour Canada report recorded on Friday, March 19th, 2021. I'm Mark Belanger. In the report this week, the plight of women mine workers in Bolivia, an historic milestone in the fight against forced labour, the U.S. adoption of the most union-friendly legislation since the 1940s, and singing... This is Radio Labour. A Canadian union is helping to improve the horrendous working conditions of poor women working in Bolivian mines. As they try to earn a little to help their families, the women suffer serious discrimination, violence, and sexual harassment. They are being helped by the Steel Workers Humanity Fund. The fund, established 25 years ago, has supported international development projects, provided emergency humanitarian aid for disasters around the world, supported food banks across Canada, and other activities. I talked to Laura Ramirez about the project in Bolivia. Ms. Ramirez is the Humanity Fund's project coordinator for Latin America. I asked her about the Steelworkers Project for women miners in Bolivia.
The project in Bolivia is a brand new partnership that the Humanity Fund has developed to address the needs of a very particular group of women workers with two organizations. For our audience to understand what these projects are about, I'll give you a little bit of background, first of the organizations and then the context. So we're going to be working with a group called Women's Coordination Association, which brings together about 21 women's organizations. And this is to strengthen their impact in terms of building capacity for women and maximizing their political involvement and promoting changes to their situation. As you know, there's a lot of poverty in Bolivia and women are the hardest impact, but particularly in the mining sector, which is where the project will be. So a little bit of the context is that Bolivia is traditionally a mining country, and back in 1985, the government went ahead and privatized the mining sector, and this left a lot of people without a job. And so many of them moved to La Paz, Bolivia, to work in the informal sector. But about 85% of those created what they call cooperative mining, which is far from being cooperative. They're just individual workers working in specific groups with very primitive manual extraction methods. And so in this context, you can imagine their situation is very precarious. But again, the groups that are mostly impacted by this kind of economic life are the women. Traditionally, women have not been allowed to be miners, to go inside the mine, because men said that they bring bad luck to the mine, right? And it's not the place for women. But nevertheless, there are hundreds of, there are many, many women that contribute to this sector in a very informal and harsh way. And so this project will target two groups in particular. They're called Payiris and Barranquilleras, which are traditional names for women who do the menial mining work. Their job is extremely insecure and underpaid. They do, you know, little things like break a rock with a little hammer, right, or extract the remaining mineral after it's been taken out of the mine. And they get paid almost nothing for that. And often the children work with them too to earn a living. And the other group is the Barranquilleras, who do the same, but they work inside the water. They immersed in water and they shovel sand and rocks to extract whatever mineral is left over from gold mines and that goes downstream in the rivers. And they try to collect all of that. But in addition to living in poverty and discrimination, there are huge levels of violence against these women, harassment and sexual violence and verbal abuse. So this project will have two main purposes. First of all, to give a voice to women, right? To teach them how to express, to occupy decision-making spaces and make decisions and contribute to changing their conditions. And in the process, building leadership, right? Leader women that will be able to contribute more to changing their situation. And the other aspect of this project will be building awareness about violence against women, all this abuse and harassment that they live on a daily basis. The interesting part of this project is that it will involve men as well, right? To make them aware that, you know, they're already poor and living in extreme conditions. And on top of that, they abuse the women who can also contribute to the economy. So, you know, and it's wrong, period. There's going to be 270 mining women who will participate in various events and training to form leadership groups and encourage them to participate in decision-making spaces. And there will be men who will participate in the violence against women workshops. And it is expected that about 5,000 people will benefit indirectly from this project. We're talking about the participants, but also their families and their children.
A major milestone in the fight against forced labor has been reached, C. Marie Ainsborough reports.
There are 40 million people around the world trapped in forced labor. They are coerced to work involuntarily through the use of violence, debt bondage, retention of identity papers, and threats of being denounced to immigration authorities. The International Labor Organization has been fighting forced labor by encouraging countries to adopt an international law called ILO Forced Labor Convention 29. The ILO is the UN agency focused on matters of work in the world. The convention was first adopted in 1930. This year, a milestone in the fight against forced labor has been reached. 50 countries have ratified the convention. This means the countries have agreed to include the provisions of the convention in their national legislation. To mark the occasion, the International Trade Union Confederation released a message thanking all the union activists who have helped reach the milestone of 50 ratifications. The ITUC is the organization which represents national union centers such as the Canadian Labor Congress at the world level. The General Secretary of the ITUC is Sharon Burrell.
Today we mark 50 ratifications, 50 nations actually ratifying the ILO Protocol for Forced Labour. This is a real achievement, and while we need to get many more nations to ratify and change the practice around decent work for all workers, we thank you for your efforts. Your lobbying has made the difference. With more than 40 million people in forced labour, the ugly end of the employment spectrum, where workers are treated as indeed modern slaves, where women are forced into child marriage, where child labour prevents young children from their opportunities through schooling and indeed to have a childhood. This scourge must be eliminated, and the ratifications of the ILO protocol is the first step. But this year, it's the elimination of child labour, and we need to focus very much on identifying where child labour exists in your countries, in your supply chains, and force governments and employers to act. We look forward to working with you. More ratifications, the elimination of forced labour, the end of the sponsorship system, and a childhood for children. End the scourge of modern slavery.
Canada ratified the ILO Convention on Forced Labour in 2011. This is C. Marie Ainsborough reporting for Radio Labour.
The United States is on the verge of passing the most pro-union legislation since the 1940s. Called the PRO Act, the legislation would make it easier for workers to join unions and bargain collectively. It is currently being considered by the lower House of Representatives. If it passes there, which is considered likely, then it will be sent to the upper House Senate for passage. The legislation is being strongly supported by the AFL-CIO, the country's largest labor federation. Richard Trumka is the AFL-CIO's president.
Together, we'll make the PRO Act the law of the land. All of us agree that a union card is the single best tool working people have in the fight to win a fair share of the value that we create every day. The right to freely and fairly organize is a patriotic belief, not a partisan one. Union members for both political parties, and we live in red and blue states. Unionism transcends ideology, and it transcends any one issue. It strengthens civil rights. It makes us safer on the job. It creates fairer workplaces, and it builds a stronger economy. And in an era of extreme polarization, nearly two-thirds of Americans approve of labor unions. Seriously, think about how hard it is to find something more than 50%, let alone 65%, that the country agrees on. It's clear, labor unifies America. So it's not surprising that nearly half of non-union workers say that they would vote to join a union today if given the chance. That's 60 million people knocking at our doors, and the PRO Act would welcome them in. It would make sure that workers can form a union if they want to, free from employer interference and coercion. The PRO Act would end the worst practices of employers, like hiring permanent replacements to punish striking workers, like forcing workers to sit through union bashing sessions, like firing workers who have the courage to speak up. And the PRO Act would do something else. It would finally ban right to work once and for all. Right to work is nothing more than a racist relic of the Jim Crow era, designed to divide us. And we plan to put it in the ash heap of history. But none of this will be easy. For decades, labor law reform has been neglected as the National Labor Relations Act has been weakened. Anti-worker politicians and big businesses have made it harder and harder to exercise the right to collectively bargain. And for decades, too many legislators elected by union members with union might have failed to pass a single bill to stop the bleeding. That ends now. The days of defense are over. This coalition of worker and civil rights, of Republicans and Democrats, of union members from sea to shining sea, is ready to go on offense. And our opponents know it. And we see them panicking. It's time to build back better with unions. And the PRO Act is our next frontier. And our next fight is in the United States Senate. We've been patient long enough. No more excuses. No more reasons why we can't do it. The PRO Act is our litmus test. and if progress is delayed or denied yet again, the suffering of the past year will only get worse. A union protects your safety and dignity on the job, and every working person deserves the protections that come with the union card. Pass the PRO Act, and more Americans will carry that power in their pocket every single day.
Now here is Obus with a new Solidarity Forever.
To the one, to the rest of us, none. Labor rights and protections becoming undone. The burdens on our backs while they slash corporate tax. Some fall through the cracks as they mask their attacks with a parody on parody. They're calling it austerity. It doesn't seem fair to me. The rich are free to heed the need to feed corporate greed and leave the rest of us in need. The rich get richer, but it's us that they bleed. When our wages are slashed and our benefits are axed. When our pensions are half, what choice do we have? Stand up, fight back. Together we are strong, so let's turn to the union.
Well, it's time to wrap up the show for another week. Keep listening to CKUT.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Come around.
just as I tell a six in stones, it ain't worth the time. Oh, come on now, sister. No. Baby, it's all right. Baby, it's all right. Baby, it's all right. Baby, it's all right. No, no, no. How to keep provoking, take the pound on the soapbox broken. No regard. How they like to troll you just to get it right. Gotta shrug it off now. Yeah. Baby, it's alright.
Montreal singer-songwriter Adelaya is on the rise. Listen to her critically acclaimed debut album, What We Say in Private, and follow-up EP, Woman Here, now available on all platforms. Follow her to be the first to hear when new music drops. Learn more at adaleamusic.com. Funded by Factor.
On est le mercredi 24 mars 2021. Et c'est la centième émission du Sleepy King qui commence.